This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Mai Elliott. I've written under the pen name of Zunglin Mai Elliott. So for my first book, The Sacred Willow, Four Generations in the Life of a Vietnamese Family, I wrote under the name of Zunglin Mai Elliott. And I did it because at that time, there were very few Vietnamese American authors.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world. How has being Vietnamese throughout the years, the identity of being Vietnamese, changed for you?
I don't think it's changed very much, if at all. I came from a very traditional, conservative family in the North. And from a very young age, it was inculcated in me, you know, the Vietnamese history and culture. And I absorb a lot of the culture just through my being with my family, living our life. And also I grew up in Vietnam. So I didn't leave Vietnam until I was 19, when my identity was already firmly established. I went to French school, absorbed a lot of French culture, loved French culture in many, many ways. And then I got a scholarship and went to Georgetown, where I absorbed American culture. And then I married an American, and I've been living in America since then. So I'm a mixture of many cultural influences, Vietnamese, French, American, but the Vietnamese influence, I would say, still remains like my basic influence. And I don't have any identity crisis at all, mainly because I'm so firmly established as a Vietnamese. Sometimes I feel, even in America, even now, I feel like I'm an outsider. But I was an outsider in many situations, so in the French schools, even in Vietnam, because of my family background, in some circles, I was an outsider. So to me, being a writer and being on the outside looking in, it doesn't bother me at all.
Right.
I just accept that as a fact of life. And I take the best out of each culture. And I think, all that has made me what I am. But basically, you know, I'm Vietnamese, and I accept that fact, and I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think being raised in one country, from your country of origin up until you're 19, but still kind of like floating in and out of the French culture, and then getting completely immersed in the American culture at 19, but still retaining the roots of Vietnamese, since you were, you know, born and raised and up to 19, gives you a very solid anchor of who you are.
Exactly. Yeah.
What was life for you like growing up in Vietnam before you left to the U.S.?
Yes, my life in Vietnam was at times was kind of tumultuous, because my family was displaced by fighting several times. So for example, when I was very low, so when the French came back in 1946 after the World War II to take back Vietnam after Vietnam had declared independence, the French attacked Hanoi, so my family fled. So we were on the run for many, many months. We ran out of money, we ran out of food, but we lived on the kindness of relatives and strangers. And then in 1954, when Vietnam was divided in two at the 17th parallel, my family fled Hanoi because my father was sure that the communists would come in and persecute us because he had worked in the French colonial administration. And then we moved to Saigon in 54. And at that time, South Vietnam was very unstable. So President Diem was battling religious groups, sects, and the Hoa Hao Kodai, but mainly the Binh Xuyen, the criminal gang, but they were well-armed. So during the fighting in Saigon between Diem and the Binh Xuyen, we were caught in the middle. And we fled during the, you know, as they were shooting each other, both sides were battling each other, and we fled, and our house burned down in the fighting. So I've known displacement, and I've known what it's like to be a refugee, to be on the run, and to really have to live on the kindness of others. And then, of course, my family fled again in 75. So we've led a rather tumultuous life, yes.
Now, when you got to Saigon in 54, you were of age, you were able to think, right? You were in your teenage years already, right?
Yeah, I was 13. And, you know, the history was complicated because when the French were in Vietnam, they tried to policy of divide and rule. So Vietnam was divided, not physically, but administratively. Vietnam was divided. So the north and central parts of Vietnam were protectorates, but the south, Cochin China, was a colony of France. So there was a division between Vietnamese. And when we fled to Saigon, we were refugees, and we were not accepted at all. A lot of people in Saigon were hostile. Those who were sympathetic to the Viet Minh, who had won and gotten half of Vietnam, were upset with us because they said, well, you know, we're finally independent. We threw out the French. Why did you flee? And the others were just didn't want us there because, you know, they said we were going to steal their jobs and steal their rice. And we were different. We spoke, you know, a different dialect, if you will. We behaved differently. They call it Bucky, where they call themselves Good Good Yuck. So we were not accepted at all. Even I remember my first day in school was very tense because we were viewed as, you know, like interlopers, carpetbaggers, and pupils were very hostile to us. But, you know, eventually we were accepted, and I was accepted in school. I made friends and did well in school. But, you know, we've known rejection, we've known discrimination, even though it's internal in the country, which is interesting.
It's so crazy to hear that a real life example of this is going on many decades before, you know, you get to the United States and you witness, you know, all the infighting here. It's a problem that basically never goes away as we are human beings, right?
Yeah. You're different, you know, and you're perceived as different. It takes time to kind of get integrated, to be accepted. But that was the case, yeah.
You know, I've kind of played with this idea, you know, of colonialism and how detrimental it is
for the people who are being colonized and how evil the movements were to just go in and take the resources of people, and French going into Vietnam and all of these, you know, the British going into India. But at the end of the day, there were some good things that came from it, some good things. And, you know, when you look back sometimes in history, and I'm coming from it with a very open mind, just sort of like talking about like the good and the bad that comes from it. But from your perspective, because you've lived through a lot of these changes, can we say there's a way to do it and here's the right way to do it? Is there a right way, or is there no way we should never go into other people's country and do that?
I don't think that's the right way to do it. You should never go into another country and take it over and tell the native people what to do and kind of lord over them and hold all the power and exploit their labor and take the resources to enrich your own country. I don't think that's something that should ever be attempted again. First of all, because it might work in the short term, but not in the long term, because no country likes to be colonized, exploited, and no native people want foreigners to come in and despise them and treat them badly and so on. But on the other hand, in Vietnam, the French did all that. But on the other hand, they did modernize Vietnam. They improved a lot of things, sanitation, hygiene, healthcare. They modernized Vietnam, built roads, bridges, ports and airports and so on, established beautiful buildings and so on. And their culture had a lot of good things going for it. Their education was very good. And we absorbed a lot of good French cultural influences, but at the end of the day, it was still a colonial regime. And like I said in my book, you know, if the French had just come in and modernized Vietnam and treated us fairly, share power, and then eventually hand back the country independence and power back to the Vietnamese, the Vietnamese would never have fought them for 9 years to kick them out. So, but, you know, despite all that, I think at the end of the day, it's still, you know, a horrible system. And it's shown over and over again, it doesn't work. And like I said, a powerful country can come in and overwhelm the natives or the people who live there, but eventually they can't stay. If the people don't accept them, they can't stay. And we've seen that in many countries.
I asked this question in a very clumsy way, and it's sort of deliberate, because the root of our, not you, but my sort of generation, I feel like sometimes the root of our insecurity is because our parents, my elders, put so much emphasis on the beauty of what the French brought and the beauty of what American powers brought. And it's sort of like this weird worship culture of these European and Western culture that makes somebody like me feel very displaced in American society. And yeah. I'm dealing with this weird kind of like figuring out, wait, what a minute, they brought such Nyingitan thing, right? Like all these modern ways of thinking, and you should be grateful that Catholicism was brought to Vietnam and solidified. But on the other hand, I'm like, no, this was not a good thing. So I want to hear it from somebody who's, you know, who's lived through what and how bad it was for, and now what I'm realizing as I'm doing more of these podcasts is it's a nuanced conversation that we have to like kind of break down and say, okay, here's where they did modernize and here's where they brought culture and here's where, you know, they should have left. And those things need to be discussed, but in I feel like in the elders' ideas, it kind of like we forget sometimes that the Vietnamese identity, or somebody like me, have always been like, I feel so minimized. My Vietnamese culture feels so minimized because of this sort of like, I have aunts who are like, they think that they're French. They think because they were tall and light-skinned, and there's just so much Euro worship and American-centric ways of thinking that we completely ignore the fact that these were very bad things that happened to a country like Vietnam.
Yeah, well, like I said, it was not totally bad, the French colonial period. I think in terms of the American and French cultural influence, there are many good things, and that's why people, basically Western civilization has spread throughout the world for many reasons, but in some ways it is superior, and in some ways it's not. So I think that perhaps the best thing to do is to recognize the good and the bad and just adopt the good and not the bad. But that's easier said than done, yeah. Because usually people mostly embrace the bad more than the good. But I don't think that either the French culture or American culture is inherently totally bad. I think all cultures have good aspects and bad aspects, and it is up to us to identify what it is that we want to adopt and follow, what it is that we don't want to, we want to reject. So if your family admire the French, you know, there are reasons why they do. And if they're Catholics, and then of course, are they Catholic?
Yes, they are.
Well, That's the reason, because the Catholicism in Vietnam is very strong, very deep rooted, and faith is very strong. In many ways, it's almost like medieval, because people accepted the faithful accepted without questioning. I think from the few times I interact with very ardent Catholics in Vietnam, you know, the people from the northern refugees, the refugees from North Vietnam who fled to the south, a lot of them were Catholics. They couldn't accept living under communism. So they hated it, because so they fled.
I mean, it's like, what a perfect system when you have a French Catholic, or, you know, this French Catholic way of looking at it, because it's perfect, because it's hierarchical, and it's impossible to leave the mentality of the Vietnamese, because it's like, you can't fight back, and it's spiritual and it's religious and it's just so organized. And so it's like the perfect storm to fit inside the 54 culture, because you bring a million people down, and it's unshakable, that structure. You have, you know, it's perplexing that, you know, it's hard to think beyond it. And, you know, a lot of us kids come from these military backgrounds, our fathers or mothers or a part of that culture, you know, Bac Nam Mai Tu, and then you add in the military culture. So there's so many of us that are questioning, why is our culture the way it is? And then we have to do some deep digging and diving into why things are the way they are. And it's confusing. Sometimes it's so confusing. And this morning, yes, I was just reading on social media, this girl, she's probably in her, you know, teens or 20s, complaining about not being able to break free from what her parents want her to do. In 2022, we have an 18-year-old girl complaining on subtle Viet traits about what to do. And I'm like, she's 18 and her parents are probably my age. But that comes from this hierarchical Bac Nam Mai Tu, I think, you know, it's just my theory that it's coming down from this waterfall of hierarchical thinking and patriarchal French Catholicism, and it's unshakable.
Yeah. Well, if you're a Vietnamese Catholic from the north, you combine, like you said, many hierarchies. You know, the Vietnamese society, traditional society, is extremely patriarchal, very hierarchical. And then the Catholic Church is the same way. And then, like you said, you're from a military background, so you have three hierarchies combined. So that stuff. I think that Asians in general, I don't think it's just Vietnamese, the parental expectations are very high, and they usually center around getting a good education, getting a good degree, get a good job, make a lot of money. So a lot of, you know, like kids who want to be musicians, they have to fight their parents'
right.
expectations, who want them to be doctors or lawyers, or, you know. So we've encountered these examples of not just Vietnamese, but Asians in general, where, you know, the parents want them to follow one path and they want to do something else. And there's conflict. I know that, like in the case of my niece, her mother was adamant that she should become a doctor, but she's wanted to be a computer scientist. And there was a big struggle. But she was, you know, determined not to be a doctor. She didn't feel the calling. So she went into computer studies at Stanford, and she's done very well. I mean, so, you know, I guess you just have to follow your own
your heart.
But it's hard because you're young. You yourself don't know. Yeah.
And you're dependent on your parents for financial backing and support and emotional. This whole support system is based on, you know, you do it my way and I will provide you with X, Y, and Z. Now, that brings me to my question with you is you left home at 19 and you fell in love and you went back to Vietnam and got married to an American. Like, how did your mom and dad back in the 60s deal with that? How did you deal with it?
Well, for me, you know, being 19 and in love, I knew what I wanted to do. But my parents were aghast. You know, my family, like I said earlier, was very traditional, extremely conservative. So the idea that one of their daughters would marry a foreigner didn't go down well. Yeah. And remember the history of Vietnam. Vietnam was colonized so many times, first by the Chinese and then the French, and then the Americans came in. So women who consorted with foreign men was always frowned upon, mainly because those who did were mainly people, so we say, ill repute.
Right.
So in my case, my decision to marry Dave upset my parents a lot, very greatly. First, because they thought it would bring shame on them. And then the entire clan was against it because they said that it would bring shame on the whole clan. And it was a very tough decision for me, but I stuck with it. And eventually they came around. Because when they finally met Dave, my husband, they realized that he was not the, you know, the Ling, the soldier.
Soldier boy, yeah.
Soldier boy, but somebody who was educated, came from a prominent family. And in Vietnam, in our tradition, family background counted very heavily. When two children get married, you check the family backgrounds more, you know.
What is the saying in Vietnamese? Sem tam, what is it?
Sem.
Lấy chồng, sem.
Sem, quên. Cái gì, sem giống, cái gì, sem
tông. Yes, so yes, the background, the family background is everything.
Yeah, so another saying in my family background is môn đăng hộ đối. Means that two families of equal standing. So when they realized that Dave, you know, he was the son of a Harvard professor, you know, so on, they realized that his family background was
solid.
Solid. So yeah. They kind of came around. Yeah.
How long did that take?
Not long. From the time I told him to the time they met Dave. It was like a couple months.
Oh, okay.
He was drafted. You know, remember there was a draft in the U.S. at the time during the Vietnam War. He was drafted out of grad school and sent to Vietnam. So, and before he went to Vietnam, he was sent to the Defense Language Institute in Monterey to study a foreign language, and he applied to study Portuguese because he was getting a PhD, and his areas of study was Latin America, Brazil. And so he wanted to study, you can brush up on his Portuguese. So he applied to learn Portuguese, but they chose him and said, oh no, you're going to study Vietnamese. So they put him in a Vietnamese class, and then after he was done, they sent him to Vietnam. But after he got to Vietnam, he applied to marry me. So they assigned him to, actually he was sent to Vietnam to monitor radio communication.
Wow.
But of the communists, but because, and he had a security clearance for that. But since he applied to marry me, he was stripped of his clearance, and they didn't use his language training at the time. They put him in charge of watching Vietnamese workers paint his barracks. So it's just because he lost his clearance.
Wow. So,
yeah. So that's why he spoke Vietnamese. And so when he came to visit my family, my parents, he could speak Vietnamese. And so they were, you know, floored. They were surprised. And because he could communicate with them, they became comfortable. Yeah. But also mainly his family background.
Right.
And the fact that he was educated, he was going to get a PhD, and Vietnamese love, you know,
PhDs.
Advanced degrees. And he was going to be a college professor. So. Yeah, turned out well. Yeah.
So did the Klan come around?
Well, it's first. So my Klan was the head of the Klan was a lady, very stern, very traditional, very conservative. So she was the daughter-in-law of the last viceroy of North Vietnam. So she was very prominent, and. She was against it, my marriage, because she said it would bring shame on the Klan. And so she boycotted our wedding. And everybody in the Klan said, oh my gosh, the matriarch said, you know, boycotted the wedding, so we shouldn't go. But then in the end, everybody was so curious about this American groom. They all came, except for the matriarch. So our wedding reception was a success because they came, and Dave could speak Vietnamese. So my father had coached him on what to say. Mm-hmm. So my husband got up and thanked everybody in Vietnamese. They all applauded.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great.
And did the matriarch ever come around?
No. I think in the end, yes, because every time. So whenever I left for US, I had to make the round, say goodbye to all my relatives, and the matriarch was the first one I had to visit. So whenever I came back, the same thing would happen. I would have to pay my respect to everybody. So in the end, when I came to say goodbye to her, she accepted me. Yeah.
That's beautiful. And it's beautiful, but it's strange in its own way, right? I mean, there's multiple things that are strange about the story of the matriarch is strange because it's such a weird time where I can't even imagine that, you know, how that kind of reality exists. And then losing your security clearance because you married a Vietnamese woman. Yeah. That today would not fly in the U.S. government. There'd be lawsuits if that happened.
Exactly. It was a different time.
Right?
Yeah. Not only that, we had to run through the gamut. You know, Dave had to apply in the army. We had to have approval from the American authorities. I had to get approval from the Vietnamese authorities. And And so my husband was not happy. He said the government had nothing to do with my personal decision. But there it was. He had to follow regulations.
The journey that you took to Georgetown, you studied foreign service. And can you tell me about that? Because I am so fascinated by that field of study. And what do you learn about when you major in something like that?
Yeah, well, it was also kind of strange because when I got my scholarship, U.S. scholarship to go to Georgetown, you know, I applied to study international relations because I wanted to be a diplomat. Of course, I envisioned living in Washington, London, Paris, Rome. You know, I didn't think of all the other countries where I could be assigned as a diplomat. But and I thought, gee, the Americans would never allow me to do this. They probably wanted me to become an engineer, learn something practical so I could help develop Vietnam. But to my utter surprise, they let me go to Georgetown and study at the School of Foreign Service. I had no idea what it meant, really. I took a lot of courses and studied international law, U.S. foreign policy. But I also studied the basic courses, the requirements, you know, money and banking, you know, history courses, Western civilization. You know, it's a very broad liberal arts education, right? So that was basically what I got. But I think what I learned mainly was the critical thinking, analytical thinking, that I never learned in Vietnam, because in Vietnam, the tradition was rote learning. And, you know, from a long time ago, everybody learned Confucianism, Confucian, the Analects by heart. And then the French came, and we continue to apply this method of learning. So when I never learned critical thinking, I learned essay writing though. So I think that later on helped my writing, because when I was in French school, we had to write a lot of essays. And so when I came to the US, to Georgetown, it was a very alien environment. I was totally lost. First of all, my English was very poor. To read my assignments, I had to stop every few words and use a French-English dictionary. So I was very slow. I didn't do well at first. And I remember studying Shakespeare plays were like torture. I adapted, and I did well, fairly well. I wasn't a straight A student, but I did fairly well. And I think that now if I ask you what you learned in college, do you remember any courses, any contents of your courses, you probably say no. But what you take away is this general education, this liberal arts education, that, and especially critical thinking. Yeah, I think that's the purpose of a higher education, at least at the
undergrad level.
Yeah, a bachelor level anyway. So I think that's what my takeaway is from my education, is this ability to think for myself, and, you know, to check in the facts and try to make sense of them and make something coherent out of all this. And I think that's the key to American liberal arts education. I think it's something that a lot of countries try to emulate, because America is such a creative country. And I remember there was a time when, like, Singapore was trying to emulate the US. You know, they were asking, why is it that Americans were so creative, inventing, you know, a lot of new things. And so I think that's a strong point of a liberal arts education in America.
I had silly romantic notions of foreign service major at Georgetown. It's like, do you study, you know, military rankings, how to fold napkins, you know, things. Silly things, right? Like, you know, government hierarchies and, you know, but I got none of that from you right now. In my mind, when I was, you know, reading about your life, I'm like, oh my God, in the 60s studying foreign service, you know, you got to study where the city halls were, how they do business and conduct business in Italy or France, but it sounds like none of it.
No. I think it's like with everything, if you get into the foreign service, kind of learn on the job, right? Mm-hmm. We study a lot about other countries, like history of Russia, the United Nations, law, international law, the U.S. general. Foreign policy, but, you know, it's just still a generalist. I think that's what it is. You call it, turns out, generalist. And then you specialize later, I think.
And you were called on by the RAND Corporation to do work for them shortly after you left Georgetown, right?
Well, I graduated from Georgetown and I returned to Vietnam. And my husband and I got married, and I had a variety of kind of jobs, nothing really meaningful. When I first came back, I got a job translating documents from English into Vietnamese in a bank. And then I was hired to do a radio broadcast for the Saigon Radio. I read the news in English on the air. Again, nobody trained me. They just threw me in and said, Here's the news. You choose what you want to say, broadcast. So I picked out news items and read them on the air without any training. And I stumble along and say, oh, excuse me.
How cool.
Over again. But, you know, that was how it went. And anyway, so I was, my husband was then in Vietnam, and his boss was a man who was also a graduate student. And who had been drafted, so they became great friends because, you know, basically they were graduate students, and the wife of this man, Susan, was working for two professors, John Donnell of Temple, and Joe Zaslav of Pittsburgh, to do research in Vietnam. So Susan was looking for them. So she said, well, they're looking for bilingual people, Vietnamese, who could do research for them. And so I was hired only basically not because I studied at Georgetown and majored in international relations, but because I could speak English, right, and Vietnamese. So the project they were researching was something called the Viet Cong Motivation and Morale. And that had been commissioned by somebody in the Defense Department. There were people who claimed that it was McNamara, and that McNamara was curious about the Viet Cong, because at the time the Viet Cong were, to the Americans, faceless enemies. You know, they didn't know who the Viet Cong were, except that they were communists and they wanted to overthrow the Saigon government. But they didn't know why people joined the Viet Cong. Why did they join the insurgency? Why did they fight so hard, even though the Americans were pounding them? And if they gave up, why did they give up? So basically trying to understand the insurgency. So these two professors, the only way to find out the Viet Cong was to talk to the Viet Cong. And how did you find the Viet Cong? You find them in the defection centers where the Viet Cong defected were kept until they were released.
Right.
And then in prisons with Viet Cong who had been captured, and later on North Vietnamese who had been sent south to help the Viet Cong who were captured or defected. So the only way to find out was to talk to them. So these two professors hired Vietnamese who were bilingual. And at that time, you know, actually, there were very few Vietnamese who could speak English well. So many of the interviewers who were hired were bilingual, but French and Vietnamese. And since these professors spoke French well, it was not a problem. So anyway, I was hired mainly on the basis that I could speak Vietnamese and English. So my job was to go into the Chiu Hoi Center, the defection centers and the jails, and talk to defectors and prisoners. And, you know, I said, well, I don't know what to do. What do I do? So they had developed a questionnaire. So when you do research, you have to have a questionnaire so that you can have a basis for comparison, right? So they gave me a list of questions and said, just go in and ask. So that was how I started.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
And it's purely coincidence because I wasn't looking for this job.
Yeah,
I was totally unqualified. And I got in because there were a few Vietnamese who could speak English. And my husband knew the wife of his boss who was working for Ren. So the roundabout, the two pure coincidence.
I realize how much luck is involved in everybody's success. Or you make a left turn here because you met somebody's wife. And
yeah.
So much of that happens and people just go with it. And when you started out in life, when you started to have this sort of understanding of like you're controlling your narrative because you apply to the US and, you know, your life changes. Did you have a direction on where you were going to go in life?
No, at that time, my destiny was to be married as soon as possible. So my parents, had a lot of children, numerous, 4 boys and 8 girls. And their worry was to get us married, before we got too old. In those days, marriages were arranged. And if a girl was considered too old, she wouldn't be married. Nobody would want to marry her because no matchmaker would bring a man to meet her, right? So it was totally arranged. So your fate depended on what the matchmaker, who the matchmaker brought, and whether your parents liked the guy that the matchmaker brought. So in my case, my destiny was really just to be married off. But I was determined not to let that happen because, first of all, I've seen that arranged marriages didn't work because I've seen my older sisters, some of them, their marriages were not, great. So I wanted to avoid that fate. And just so happened, I read in the paper the announcement that the Americans were recruiting high school students to go to the U.S. to study. But in order to do so, they had to apply and pass an exam. So I applied and I took an exam and my English was very poor because I had studied in French school and I studied English there because the choice was either English or Latin. And I thought, well, I'm going to study English because I was enamored of American culture, pop culture, through movies and music at the time. So I studied English. So I took this test. Now I realize that it was an SAT. because there were a lot of multiple choices and true and false. And but somehow I managed not only to pass, but to pass with flying colors, because I was one of 15 students in all of Vietnam who were chosen to go to the U.S. with a scholarship. So talking about coincidence.
Wow.
That was another coincidence. If I hadn't seen that article, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Because my parents just wanted to marry me off. The last thing they wanted to do is for me to go to a foreign country, you know, and probably marry a foreigner, which they were against. So that's how I ended up at Georgetown.
In your years of being away and married off to an American and, you know, living basically outside of your family, when you look back into like your family, like the sisters and brothers, like, were there any thoughts that were going on in your mind at the time? Like, whoa, that could have been me.
Sure. Yeah. Like, there were matchmakers who were bringing people to meet me, just to check me out. You know, as we call it, sema, check out the girl. And so they were bringing, you know, young man to my house. And so that really alarmed me. You know, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to be married off by my sisters as soon as I finish high school. So so it was coincidence that I got away. You know, I found a scholarship. My parents didn't want me to go, but they were progressive enough to let me go, even though they had a lot of misgivings and fears about what would happen next. But that changed my life, and meeting my husband changed my life, and going back to Vietnam and getting the job at RAND changed my life. Because, you know, it's just like you said, the things that happen that you don't plan that really kind of change the course of your life. Yeah.
And then April 30, I can't imagine what you were feeling, because you're kind of like an outsider at this point, right? You probably holding a different passport.
Yes.
Your rights and your access changes. What was going on in your mind as you are witnessing all of this happening?
Oh, well, I went back to Vietnam in 1973. That was the last time I was there before the end of the war. And at that time, the Saigon government seemed very strong. It had like a million men under arms in different, you know, branches of the armed forces. It had received $2 billion worth of military equipment from the United States. The United States continued to help it with aid and, armament supplies. So I thought, we're pretty strong. The communists might take over eventually, but not anytime soon. So I thought it was, if the communists took over, it would be a long kind of process, but not a sudden takeover. So anyway, I left feeling pretty confident. And so in 75, we were living in Ithaca. My husband was getting his doctorate at Cornell when it happened. And when the communists, what they call the spring offensive, it took place in starting in March of 75. I couldn't believe it, because the provinces, the places fell so quickly, you know, Ban Mi Thuat, Plek Ku Kon Thu, and then suddenly Da Nang, Hue, and it's like a domino falling very fast. And then there was talk of that South Vietnam would be truncated, and that the South Vietnamese government would hold on to the Mekong Delta. And then certainly the communists were within sight of Saigon. So I watched all this with disbelief and kind of, you know, incredulity, because I thought, oh my gosh, how could this happen so quickly? And so, yeah, it was a complete shock.
It's fascinating to hear from your point of view as a kid who's grown up entirely for, you know, listening from my parents' point of view and their friends, you know, people who really didn't speak English, you know, coming to the United States and, you know, retelling it from their harrowing perspective. And then to have a Vietnamese person, you know, that is actually older than my parents speaking in English, telling me your recounting of the of your tracking the developments from the United States, from Ithaca. It's very interesting.
Yeah, of course, my family went through what your family did at the end in April 75. They too fled and they were plucked by helicopters at the very last moment, just before the communists, the tanks, you know, came in and took Saigon. Yeah. So they went through what your family did, you know, they were at Thanson Nhit waiting to be evacuated, you know, rockets were exploding. So yeah, it was harrowing.
Did they ever call you ahead of time, like the week before or? You know,
well, no, we were in Ithaca. And remember, at the time, communication was not like it is now. You know, recently, the fall of Kabul, I watched some Afghans being extricated with cell phone. You know, somebody outside, a Marine, would text somebody in the crowd and said, "Where are you?" And he would send a picture, say, "This is what I'm wearing. This is what my family look like." And, you know, the Marines could go in and find them and check them out. So remember, it wasn't like that. So I couldn't even call them. They couldn't call me. They only my older brother had a phone. Remember, it's very hard to imagine, but having a phone in Saigon was very rare. So I tried to, I couldn't get in touch with them. But somebody, a relative in Washington, told me that he had heard that if I could send a cable to Saigon asking my family to call me, then I could communicate with them. So I thought, oh, okay. So I sent a cable thinking, okay, nothing is going to happen. But the cable went through. So my oldest brother went to the central post office to call me. Remember, at the time, the only way to make overseas calls was to go and stand in line at the post office and get in this booth and call. And so one night the phone rang. I was asleep in Ithaca. And I heard my brother, so statics were extremely bad. And it's not like talking on WhatsApp right now. So he called me and he had very little time to talk to me. So I said, "Are you planning on staying or leaving?" He said, "We want to leave, all of us." And I said, "Well, I see what I can do." So now at that time, there was no evacuation. The only way you could leave was on commercial flights, if you could get tickets, right? So that's all we could say. The line went dead. And so I thought, I counted 40 people. And my husband was a graduate student. And I was working in the library earning $2.75 an hour. I thought, 40 people, how am I going to get them out?
Wow.
By commercial flights. So I called my mother-in-law and she said, "Don't worry about it, we'll help you." And I said, "What am I going to do with 40 people when they came?" She said, at that time, my father-in-law had retired from Harvard, where he was teaching, and bought a farm in Virginia. And so my mother-in-law said, "Don't worry, we'll help you get them out. And when they came, they can come and stay with us. We have room on the farm." So I said, "Well, okay, of course, events happen very fast. You know, commercial flights stop." So I think only there were Air France was still the only one that operated, but even their flights were, I don't know how many flights they had, one or two. So it was impossible to get them out by commercial airplanes. So then I heard about the evacuation. And in those days, you could not just come in the U.S., you know, to seek asylum. but the Defense Department had issued something, what was it they call? Some kind of protocol that allowed Vietnamese refugees to come, give them permission to come. So I thought, well, I'm married to an American. Maybe I could get them in. So I drove to Buffalo, the immigration naturalization office in where near where I live. The only place was Buffalo. So I drove with a group of Vietnamese students who were also trying to get their families.
Wow.
So we drove to Buffalo and I filled out all the paperwork. And it took me the longest because I had 40 people. Yeah, I had to fill out paperwork for 40 people. And a lot of the names were my newly born nephews and nieces. They were babies. I didn't know their names. So I would say like little baby girl or little baby boy. Wow. In my application. So I sent all that in, not knowing if anything would happen. And so Saigon collapsed. And so I thought, well, they were stuck. But then one night, the phone rang, and it was one of my brothers. They had landed in Camp Pendleton in California. They said, we're here. That was the first time I knew they had made it. But so.
All of them made it?
All of them made it except for those who decided to stay. So the reason
because of your paperwork, they all made it?
Yes. Isn't that amazing? And this is what happened. I later found out that my application, I had also written to the State Department, you know, just like I tried to do everything I could. So I wrote to the State Department as well as applying through the Justice Department. I just wrote to the State Department. And for some reason, Henry Kissinger found out about it. Now, Henry Kissinger was one of my father-in-law's closest students at Harvard. So he wrote his dissertation under my father-in-law. And he was like a disciple of my father-in-law. And my father-in-law was instrumental in helping him start his career. So somehow Henry Kissinger knew about this, and he sent a cable, or had his office sent a cable to the American embassy under his name, saying, get all these people out, all the names, including names like baby girl, baby boy. And so I had listed my brother's phone number. Two of my brothers had phones, so I listed their phone numbers. And one night, somebody in the embassy, American embassy, called my brother, who is now in Canada, called him and said, tomorrow at 2 p.m., gather at this villa in downtown Saigon. We'll bus you to the airport and get you out. So then my brother had to rush around telling everybody, you know, get to this place tomorrow. So in the rush, some decided not to go, or some were not in Saigon because they were in the army and stationed somewhere else. So anybody who could or wanted to gather at this villa, a bus came and took them to the airport. And so they waited and waited all night. And, you know, in the morning, rockets started to fall, exploding. And then they thought, well, you know, no way they were going to get out. But the Americans started bringing in helicopters. And they were picked up and flown to the USS Hancock in the South China Seas. And from there, they went to Guam and then to Pendleton. But again, pure coincidence that Henry Kissinger found out about this. You know, if he hadn't found out, I don't think they would have gotten out, because my application, I don't think ever got approved at the State Department, at the Justice Department.
God, what a story.
Yeah, I still have a cable with under the name of Henry Kissinger. Yeah, so it just happened that, you know, he was my father-in-law's student and was very loyal to my father-in-law. And he had met Dave, you know, my husband, and he knew about me. Maybe he knew Dave had married a Vietnamese. So all that help. Yeah.
Did you know the story of Henry Kissinger before that happened? The connection with your father-in-law?
Oh, yeah. But I didn't send my letter to Henry Kissinger. I just sent it to the State Department. Yeah.
What an amazing story.
Yeah.
Now, you inside of your family, you must get sort of some preferential treatment because of that credit to the, you know, bringing everybody out. I mean, or, you know, is it something that, because I can imagine the Vietnamese tradition, like loyalty weighing so heavy, that mangaunga, is that something that you feel in your family? In the most humblest way to answer that, I'm very curious about that sort of lifelong, I owe you this for doing that for our family.
Well, yeah, first of all, it was family love and family obligation and loyalty too. And so, yeah, everybody in my family who got out because of me. Now, other people got out on their own because one of my brothers who was working for the American, what is it, Dow, Defense Attaché Office or something like that. So he managed to get his family out, plus, you know, some of the nephews and nieces that he could get out at the time. So his plan after he flew out with the kids was to come back and get the rest of the family, but of course he couldn't come back. So the rest I got out, and then I had a sister who was working for Chase Bank, and Chase Bank got her and her family out, except for a son who decided to stay. So I didn't get everybody out, but the ones that I got out, yeah, they were grateful. They're still grateful. And of course, they're grateful to my husband as well, because of my husband's connection with Henry Kissinger, who really got them out. So, yeah. So in the end, at the beginning, nobody liked the idea of me marrying Dave, but in the end, Dave and his family connection who got them out. Yeah.
The cycles of irony and how things turn out in a human being's life is you have no choice but to keep an open mind to all of the things that are happening. And that's the lesson about living, and the more stories we hear, it's like you have to drop all the prejudice that you have going into matters of humanity.
Exactly. Yeah, of course, and I'm grateful to my mother-in-law. If she hadn't said, I get them out and they can come live with me, I might not have the gumption to do it. Yeah. You know? Because how was I going to support 40 people when, you know, my husband was still in graduate school? But I wanted to do it very badly, and she was kind of the reason that kind of took me over the hump. Yeah. Fortunately, she never had to feed 40 people, but she was prepared to do it. She said, oh, you know, we can grow food on the farm. We'll just plant more potatoes, you know? Wow. So she was a wonderful person. Yeah.
Amazing. Just amazing story. If your father and grandfather and great-grandfather had voices today and they saw the development of Vietnam and all the changes, what do you think all these men and perhaps women what would their comment be? How do you think they would feel about where Vietnam has landed today in history?
Of course, I think they would be stunned by the changes, because, you know, they couldn't anticipate how Vietnam could change, you know, how the modern world could bring the changes. First of all, that the world would be so modernized. And so I think they would be stunned, and they probably would be unhappy, because a lot of the things they believed in, the institutions they were loyal to, the monarchy, the Confucianism, the the way of life dictated by Confucian rituals and relationships, the rigorous relationships between parents and children, you know, the absolute power the parents had over children, all that is gone. I think they probably would be very lost and probably unhappy. Because they thought that world was wonderful. They thought that social system hierarchy was great. And of course, they wanted to maintain it. And even when the French came, they fought hard because they didn't want to give up that culture, that way of life. And they were against changes. Of course, they eventually came to embrace changes because they realized that modernization was the only way to save Vietnam from French domination, because they could see how Japan modernized and became a powerful country. And they thought Vietnam, reluctantly, they thought Vietnam should follow that route. But at the beginning, no, they were very adamant about against any changes. So I think they would be very aghast, you know, lost if they had to come back now. And even we, you know, now we kind of, sometimes we're surprised by the pace of change ourselves, because things are changing very fast, especially with technology.
Folks my age and, you know, I would say a lot of the kids are, you know, in their 30s and 20s are running the tech scene and the banking, and smart young minds have taken over the modernization of Vietnam. And it's no longer the country that these older folks think. And
So I think that's the case, because the older people left with this image of Vietnam, which became ossified because they never gone back to see the changes. So in their mind, Vietnam was what it was. But like you said, it's changed a lot. And I've seen statistics that said that like 75% of the Vietnamese now in Vietnam were born after the war or soon after. Or soon before it ended. So to them, the Vietnam War, like for you, is just something that happened in the past in history. They don't have any memory of it. And they're very open, I think.
Yes.
And somebody did a opinion survey and found that 80% of the Vietnamese people admire the United States, think it's the best country in the world. And a lot of Vietnamese who have money send their children here to study. You'd be amazed how many Vietnamese students are here, you know, not like as numerous as the Chinese, but that, you know, how many? 60,000 or maybe more. And, you know, they when I go back to Vietnam, I'm surprised because there's so many people speak English. They admire the United States greatly. You know, they use the modern technology. They admire American culture, pop culture, or especially Korean pop culture.
Yeah.
So, like you said, it's a very different country. Yeah.
Can you imagine the young kids that are sent in the last 5 years to the United States to go to college, the culture shock that they feel once they get here with the elders? I wonder if they get briefed by their families or institutions before they leave to understand that there's like this vestige of war that's a big chunk of you know, our culture here in Vietnamese American society. But what if they get briefed like, hey, this is what you have to kind of be careful, you know, like there's these.
I think they're careful. I think they know the hostility you know, within the Vietnamese American community.
And that's unfortunate.
Yeah. But I think they're aware of it.
Were you like one of the first to be nominated, a Vietnamese, to be nominated for a Pulitzer?
I couldn't think of. Probably. Yeah. And Nguyen was is the first one who won.
Won it, yes.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. So I just wanted to say about my book, The Sacred Willow. The reason I wrote that at the time, Americans knew very little about Vietnam. They knew it as a war, but they didn't know it as a country, like a saying meant. So my aim was to explain that Vietnam had a long history, culture, tradition, just explain Vietnam in general to the American, the average American reader. But also my secondary objective was to capture this history for the next generations of Vietnamese, in America, because I suspected that they didn't know about all these periods, especially the period of the 19th century, late 19th century, when the French arrived, and what Vietnam was like, and how the French transformed it. Why did the Vietnamese fight the French to get rid of them? What happened during the Cold War? Why was the two blocs in Vietnam, the communists and the non-communists, duking it out? And, it's just the transformation of Vietnam because of the war and the American involvement and the consequences of the war on Vietnamese society, not just physically, but socially. And I wanted to capture all that before generations that lived through that period passed. Of course, for the earlier period, I had to rely on the memories of my father and his uncles and aunts and so on. But at least I captured that. So I just wanted to make sure that this history doesn't disappear with the disappearance, the death of people of those generations. So I hope I've succeeded and that readers who read my book will find it useful and help them connect better with the country that their parents or grandparents came from.
Well, I can tell you how much appreciation I have. I mean, as I'm getting more into this work, I'm so grateful that there are people like you that exist that have documented, that have told the stories, because as far as I was concerned for many years, like Vietnam didn't happen until after 1976 to me, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was a kid, I always thought that history only started to begin when I was born. I mean, that's how, silly young boys, I mean, young kids think. And you kind of get locked into this reality that your mom and dad, after leaving the country, was the sort of, that's when history for us began. Maybe shortly before that, there were these years that they were in the military in Vietnam. But for the most part, they don't even know what happened in the 19th century in Vietnam. Our parents don't know. Yeah. No. And then the articulation, the ability to articulate it in a very, I want to say Western format of communication, is so important too, because I think that your book, Chi Nguyen, Phan Quế Mai, The Mountain Sing, these kinds of books exist so we will have strength in our identity to know that we are not just since 1976. we have hundreds and hundreds of years of people, of culture, generations of rich, vast history that exists.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that can help, Vietnamese who don't know much about this. So, they came from a great culture with great traditions. And I think that can help reinforce their identity and maybe make them feel proud of the heritage that they have. You know, it's something to be proud of. And the more you know about it, the more pride you can derive from it. It has a lot of flaws and weaknesses, but on the whole, there are a lot of things that are great about it. The love of literature, education, poetry, music, family loyalty, things like that. I think that there are values that endure. And it's one way, I think, I hope, and I think they still endure even in Vietnam.
You and Viet Thanh Nguyen, I watched that that talk. I think it was some at a university somewhere in Claremont or Laverne or something like that.
Yeah.
And the two of you were talking and making jokes about how pain allows you and him to be writers, and you can cultivate. You're allowed to do this work because of that, and you wouldn't remove it. You wouldn't, if under any circumstances, because it fuels your, you know, and it never goes away. And shame for me has always been existing, and I don't think I can ever get rid of it. Shame of being a Vietnamese person. Because growing up in the 80s, it was like, you know, I was a gook. I was kids in the neighborhood, black kids, white kids, Mexican kids. We were gooks. We were zipper heads. We were, you know, Didi Mao. That was what that's how they made fun of us. And these aren't things that I get to talk much about because it's Full Metal Jacket. It's Rambo. It's all of these films that I grew up in the thick of that. And, you know, I've never really been able to voice it up until this podcast, now that I'm doing it. So I'm finding out that there's just like this internal shame that it's not going to go away. And it's okay, because it drives motivates me to replenish the future generations with a sense of pride, and, you know, not to fall into the same pitfalls of culture that, you know, I turned it off for many years and wanted to, and then only dated white women because of my desire, my burning desire to not be, you know, attached to the Vietnamese culture. So, you know, doing this work really relieves the pain of that shame. And, you know, it's a thing that, like, I really identified with you and Viet when you guys were talking about, you know, certain things drive us, and this is one thing that drives me. So knowing the details of your life, as a person who is Vietnamese, brings so much relief to me on an emotional level.
That's good. You know, here, listening to you talk, I realized that I was never subjected to what you were subjected to in the United States. I came, you know, I went to Georgetown. So I avoided all of that childhood trauma that you went through. And that's why I guess I'm so comfortable in my skin because of that, because I came already formed. I knew my background. I was proud of my family heritage. And fortunately, I avoided what you and a lot of young kids who came and had to go through those traumas of childhood. I avoided all that. My generation endured the traumas of war.
Right.
And of being displaced. But your generation, you came here and you felt like you were not accepted, you were rejected, you were vilified, made fun of, and but your trauma is very deeply psychological, I think. Somebody like Viet is really, he must be a model.
Total.
But also, it is also reassuring, I guess, to Vietnamese.
Fearless, yeah. And we have him, and we have Ocean Vuong.
Yes.
Yeah. We have Bang Nguyen, the film director. All these young thinkers that really... Yes. And each of them...
All the people who appeared on your program, you know, like Doan, I met on Sunday. And I think that Vietnamese Americans are getting recognized, you know? And I think over time, it will just get better.
And I won't stop. This is my lifelong goal and mission to put the Vietnamese on the map globally, because, you know, why not? Because, you know, I think that it's our time, and I think it's a good thing that Vietnamese around the world realize that we are one people, and there's a lot of beauty in our collective experience.
Yeah, I think what you're doing is great, because you feature all these Vietnamese with great achievements that otherwise other people would not have heard of, because they're not celebrities, but they've done great things, you know, very laudable wonderful things. So I really enjoyed, you know, discovering them myself. And so thank you for doing this. I think you're doing a great service to the Vietnamese community.
Thank you. I wish my reasons for doing it was a little bit more grand and a little bit more not so rooted in shame. But I guess however we get there. Whatever fuel we need to get to where we need to go, we, you know, on the record, it is the way it is. And, that's mm-hmm. history.
Yeah. Well, that's a good motivation. Otherwise, you might just be sitting in front of a TV and watching some streaming service. So, well, anyway, I thank you for having me and I congratulate you on what you're doing, like, you know, getting the Vietnamese community to know about all these Vietnamese who have done great things. So I think that's a worthwhile project.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I value your time so much and appreciate it.
My pleasure. And keep on going. You're doing great work.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. At the Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.